Thank you, Francesco and Nina, for organising this lovely meeting. I really enjoyed myself this week, and also next week, I hope, when I come back for a couple of days. Before we start, I just want to say that I don't want you to try to waste time taking notes, because almost all of the substantial content I'm going to describe, apart from the jokes and history and things, is in this review with John Keating, and there's a little bit more, but the whole talk, apparently, is going to be on the web, I think, the Newton Institute website. So don't waste time trying to scribble and inhibit me from going fast. That's what the effect would be. Now, when Nina and Francesco wrote to me, inviting me to give a talk here, I said no at first, because I haven't been working on this subject for rather a long time, with a little exception I'll mention towards the end, but not substantially. I've enjoyed several intellectual reincarnations since the days of quantum chaology. Lately I've been working a lot on optics, and I didn't intend to speak about this if it weren't for two events. I'm going to lower the tone of this immediately before I even get started, because it was reported to me that from the women's bathroom in Wolfson College you could see a curious optical phenomenon through the irregular bathroom window glass. So I went there and with my digital camera, and I was protected from accusations of improper behaviour by Guler Ergun, who held the door open while I was in there with my digital camera, this picture, which actually is, I'm not going to explain why, it's a structurally stable singularities of a gradient map. I say that because of mathematicians. Now, that would be the end of it, but the same night, which was yesterday, I went to my room and took a shower, and looking from inside the shower, through the glass of the shower, outside, I saw this monster. whose existence is an illusion springing from the Fermat-Hamilton principle and the superposability of solutions of linear wave equations. Now, you'll be thinking that this reinforces your low opinion of English humour, and I'm going to encourage you in that, because I have one more thing to tell you of this type. In the Royal Society in London, they've recently refurbished the men's room. Before that, for at least 20 years I've been going there, you would stand there and looking at the porcelain and china in front of you, on which was the logo of the manufacturer, Zeta. I did take some photographs of that, which I don't have with me, but I can tell you that the solemn and mostly elderly gentleman using that place will look very unconvinced by my explanation of why I was in there with a camera yet again. Now, in case you think that I spend my life in these places with a camera, I have to tell you that I've now exhausted the totality of my lifetime experiences of that sort. Okay. Now, Nina did persuade me by asking me to give some historical account. Now, history is subjective. I mean, Auriol put it very well in his lecture, which, by the way, had the absolutely perfect degree of overlap and underlap with mine. I couldn't have, as well as in itself being very good, it was had just this right preparation. He put it very well. I mean, the facts of history are moderately easy to establish. They're more or less objective, but you have to choose which facts to describe and how much emphasis to give them. And this is a very good way to lose one's friends, a number of whom are here. So I hope it won't happen. I don't want to see that. There's a bit more I in this talk than I normally would like to utter, but there's no alternative to that. So this is going to be about the mingling of cultures from physics and from mathematics. Now, there are two kinds of people. Some people don't like that. They like cultures to be pure and isolated, and some people do like that. They enjoy this mingling. And in human affairs, this is the distinction between bad people and good people, although we all share a bit of both those qualities. And I'm absolutely and unashamedly an impurist in these matters. Now, this connection with Zeta, which will come actually in quite a while, you'll have to bear with me, is embedded in semi-classical asymptotics. Now, I know some of you are mathematicians, so let me give you a two-sentence lecture course on mechanics. Classical mechanics is geodesics on manifolds, one sentence. Quantum mechanics is spectrum of the Laplacian or Laplace-Beltrami operator on the same manifold, second sentence. That's it. Of course, there's a lot more. I mean, we call spectra energy levels. We call eigenvalues energy levels. I'll use this terminology. And the semi-classical connection is a matter of asymptotics, that when you look at the very high eigenvalues, you should expect to see some connections with the geodesics on the underlying manifold. And they're very deeply hidden, and that's why the subject is very hard. And as a branch of asymptotics, it's about the most difficult that we study. And asymptotics pervades physics, by the way. So that's why this is an interesting subject. In 1972, Kate Mount and I wrote a review, Semi-Classical Approximations in Wave Mechanics, which is now what I call prehistoric semi-classical mechanics. Now, during the writing of that, Martin Gutzwiller's paper expressing spectra as sums over periodic orbits, which was already mentioned, appeared. And I'm very proud of what we wrote. The last sentence of that very long review, more than 100 pages, was, finally, the difficulties raised by Gutzwiller's theory of quantization, they didn't converge, and so on, which is perhaps the most exciting recent development in semi-classical mechanics, should be studied deeply in order to provide analytical insight into those systems previously almost intractable where no separation of variables is possible. Now, no separation of variables, I knew what that meant, but I didn't know anything about chaos. And our paper was sent by the journal for review to Ian Percival, who was a theoretical physicist a few years older than I am in London, whose name I knew. He'd worked on some semi-classical asymptotics himself. And he also studied statistical physics quite a lot. And he came to visit me. He said, look, it's a very good article, do publish it. But you know, it's all going to be out of date because there's this new subject called chaos. So I said, what's that? Okay, so he explained to me, he'd been reading papers by Arnold and by Sinai, and there were these wonderful new developments. And I found them very exciting too. I also at that time saw the paper of Balin and Bloch, which was already described by Auriol. I didn't know anything about the Selber trace formula, that understanding came much later. Now, Ian Percival in 1973 wrote a paper which I think was the seed of quantum chaology, because he said very clearly, in a way that actually Gutzwiller didn't, he understood non-separability, but chaos was not quite there. What Gutzwiller did was provide the tool, as we'll see, a wonderful, totally indispensable, fundamental tool. But Percival said there has to be some difference in quantum mechanics, in the spectrum, between those systems which in classical mechanics are regular, they have conserved quantities, constants of motion, and those systems which are chaotic, sensitive to initial conditions, exponentially unstable. And he called this the regular and the irregular spectrum. He had some ideas of what these spectra might look like, and this was the beginning, the first bud of seed, I would say, of quantum chaology. And I was very excited by it. I thought about it in the next few years. And in 1976, I was musing to my colleague Balazs Gyurfi, who was a condensed matter physicist. I said, look, how could one describe these energy levels spectra in an irregular system? And he said, what about random matrix theory? And I said, well, I don't know what that is. And so he sent me to the book of Porter, which has been mentioned, a collection of articles. And again, I found this completely wonderful. And I then immediately realized, but actually, as I'll make very clear, didn't work on properly, immediately realized that the spectra of a classically chaotic system had to obey random matrix rules, although my understanding of them was and remained for a long time quite rudimentary. And the argument was this, you see. What was interesting about classical chaos was not that systems behave unpredictably. Because, you know, it had been known for centuries that if you have a complicated system, many degrees of freedom, you expect to get complicated behavior. And the whole science of statistics had been developed to deal with such behavior. The new thing about chaos was, classical, was that simple systems, as Auriol said, like this stadium billiard, particle bouncing around, could behave unpredictably. They would be unstable. And so, and this I understood. And so it was very clear that in nuclear physics, the idea was a nucleus is complicated, this was Wigan's idea, and therefore it could have a spectrum which might be described by random matrix theory. Well, it was a very natural step to say, well, if you have a system which isn't complicated in its description, simple thing like this, but in its behaviour, maybe the same random matrix statistics would apply to the energy levels. But I didn't pursue this thought. Instead, Michael Tabor came to Bristol, and we pursued, in a sense, the opposite thought. We looked at systems which were integrable, and we wondered, what are their statistics like? And we found, to our surprise, that if the system has more than one degree of freedom, the way in which the different families of regular levels interacted was to give an uncorrelated spectrum. And I just want to quote from the introduction. It seemed possible that the levels of the irregular spectrum might repel one another, and that the levels of the regular spectrum might be uncorrelated. The first possibility has not been investigated, 1976. This paper is concerned with the second, that is, with a study of the level spacing distribution for the regular spectrum. Now, actually, it wasn't true it hadn't been studied, because, as mentioned, Zaslavsky and Filonenko had written a paper in 73 or 74 proposing to look at spectra, but they had a wrong idea. I mean, it was just unfortunate. It was a good beginning, but it was a wrong direction. Now, we were invited in 1977, Michael Tabor and I, to a meeting in Como on chaos, and it was the first international meeting on chaos. Very lovely atmosphere, very, very exciting. And there we learned more about this stadium of Bunimovic, and we had the idea, Michael and I, which we talked about at the meeting, of understanding the quantum mechanics of this. We called it the quantum bathtub, because the vibrations will be like oscillations of water in the bathtub. Again, we didn't do it, but Steve McDonald and Alan Kaufman were there, and they said, well, we'll try to do it. And they went away and started their calculus, which I didn't hear about for another couple of years. Well, at that time, just at 1977, I saw Don Zagier's article on prime numbers in the zeroth volume of the Mathematical Intelligencer. I would like to tell you today, it's a lecture, his inaugural lecture, about a subject which, although I've not worked on it myself, has always extraordinarily captivated me, and which has fascinated mathematics from earliest times, namely the question of distribution of prime numbers. And then there was this very romantic paragraph. There are two facts about the distribution of prime numbers, of which I hope to convince you so overwhelmingly that they will be permanently engraved on your hearts. The first is that, despite their simple definition and role as the building blocks of natural numbers, the prime numbers belong to those arbitrary and ornery subjects studied by mathematicians. They grow like weeds among the natural numbers, seeming to obey no other law than that of chance, and nobody can predict where the next one will sprout. The second fact is even more astonishing, which states just the opposite, that the prime numbers exhibit stunning regularity, and that there are laws governing their behaviour. They obey those laws with almost military precision. I found this very romantic. It went into my head. He talked about the Riemann zeta function. I vaguely understood what he wrote, not much. And it was in a separate compartment, until much later, from these other considerations which were fast developing. Now, in 1979, MacDonald and Kaufman wrote their physical review letter in which they had announced their level spacing distribution for the stadium. Now, there it is. Now, you know, nowadays we think that's pretty poor, but it was the first, and they did show some. They said, look, it's kind of level repulsion, and they compared this, you see, with the Poisson that Michael Tabor and I had found, because of much easier calculations, giving a negative exponential for the different classes of integrable systems. So this was the first example of level repulsion. And meanwhile, I was also trying to compute a chaotic system. It took me longer. The Sinai billiard. The Sinai billiard is you have a torus in two dimensions with a circular obstacle, and then the particle bounces around the torus, hitting this obstacle. Now, the torus is the periodized plane, so the Sinai billiard is like tennis among the trees, a regular orchard of trees. And there were techniques from solid state physics which I could adapt to compute some of those energy levels, and I was lousy at computing, and I just computed a few levels, and I didn't publish it for a while. I announced the results in 1979 at the New York Academy meeting, and I went there with John Hannay, who had just come to me a couple of years before. We'd started working on the cat map, which actually plays only a tangential role in this story, but many of you will know in other contexts, quantizing linear automorphisms of a torus, as mathematicians would say. But anyway, my level spacing distribution, unfortunately, well, actually not unfortunately, fortunately, I didn't compare it with the proper random matrix theory, because it wouldn't have agreed very well, actually. I didn't try to do it. I just drew this curve. This looked vaguely like the random matrix result, and it does look vaguely like it, but it doesn't satisfy a proper comparison, because I had too few levels, too few energy levels. Now, in late 1981, I visited Ecole Polytechnique and gave lectures on this class of subjects, semi-classical asymptotics and chaos and so on, and showed these pictures. And that's where I met Oriol Bouygues and Marie-Joya Giannone. And I was very pleased to meet them, because they were very enthusiastic about this subject, and they knew what I didn't know, which is they had this wonderful background in nuclear physics and knew a lot more about random matrix theory than I did. And a couple of years later, 83 to 84, they wrote it, 84 it was published, came their famous papers, two of them, one in Physical Review Letters and one in Journal de Physique. I know certainly, I can reveal, that the one in Physical Review Letters had problems with a referee from which it had to be rescued. And what they did was two things. Now, the first thing was to repeat the calculations that MacDonald Kaufman had done and that I had done for these two systems, using the same numerical methods, but with much better computation and much more sharply focused and convincingly established. You've seen these pictures already. That's the stadium, and this is Sinai's village. You didn't see it. That's with a symmetry removed. It's bouncing in this little triangle with a circle removed. That's the first thing. Now, you know, it always happens that after an idea developed, people come and they do it better and better and better. The real importance of their paper, forgive me emphasizing this, actually, Oriol, if this is how I saw it, was that it drew attention to a world of statistics much wider than just the level spacing distribution, which turned out to be very pregnant in what followed. And in particular, they looked at the rigidity. Now, nobody's said what this is, so I shall say what it is. If you take a stretch of eigenvalues, later there'll be Riemann zeros, but eigenvalues now, very high up, and fit this stretch, a short stretch, in comparison with the number below, but still it could be a large number, with the best straight line you can, then rigidity is the mean square fluctuations. You slide that straight line up and down along the spectrum. And it's a good statistic, because actually, as Dyson had shown, it has good statistical properties itself. If you only have a finite number of samples, that's a detail, it doesn't matter. The beauty of it was that instead of looking just at correlations over distance involving a few level spacings, you could look at over larger level spacings. And then there was this beautiful logarithmic shape, which agreed wonderfully with computations that they did. And here's Poisson, showing that it's absolutely, totally wrong. Now, this emphasized an acute problem. You see, these are two very different systems, but they have the same statistical properties. And the acute problem was, where does random matrix theory universality come from? The same behavior in different systems, in classically chaotic systems. Why do you have it? They wrote a review that same year, 1984, which I devoured, and which showed some sequences of levels and also a sequence of zeros of the Riemann zeta function, and mentioned Don Zagier's article, which I then recalled, but still didn't quite click, but I remembered it. Now, John Hannay, also in 1984, visited Alfredo Osorio de Almeida in Brazil and returned with their famous classical sum rule, which turned out to be a crucial ingredient in this behaviour. And I'll talk about it later, I'll tell you what it is, but showing that the intensities, the squares of the coefficients in this series of Gutzler of long periodic orbit, the squares, had a behaviour which reflected a certain classical universality, a kind of phased space democracy. I mean, the idea is roughly this, that if you take the manifold in phase space on which orbits live, a given energy, the energy surface, let's say, and you draw periodic orbits up to period T, Then as tea gets longer and longer, they get more and more complicated, and when tea is very large, the slightest coarse graining will give you, in some sense, a uniform covering, which you can then describe in a much simpler way. I'll talk about it later more, but this, they were very proud of this, and rightly so. Another thing that happened then was Marco Robnik came to Bristol, and we started working on systems without time reversal symmetry, because we knew there was these different ensembles, and the ones that have been studied so far have time reversal symmetry, and what that meant is when you go back to the level spacing distributions, they linear at the origin, whereas without time reversal symmetry they'd be quadratic, and this of course became very important later. Now, 1985 came a paper that disturbed me a lot. It was by Cassati, Chirikov and Guarnieri, and they did computations for a rectangle billiard, repeating what Michael Tabor and I had done, but using this rigidity statistic. And they said, ah, Berry and Tabor are wrong, because if you go for a long distance, you get the Poisson, but then the behaviour changes. You see, here's the level spacing. This is only up to four spacings. Beautiful, beautiful fit to the Poisson, as we had found. But then with this rigidity, they found different cases. As they looked higher and higher up in the spectrum, the Poisson behaviour persisted for longer, but it always saturated eventually. Now, I quickly said, look, we're not wrong, because we only spoke about asymptotics, and there's a different kind of asymptotics here. But nevertheless, it was very important to understand another acute problem. Where did this breakdown of Poisson come from, and was there a similar breakdown of the random matrix statistics? Now, I was on a train in 1985 to Bielefeld, and then south to Heidelberg. I remember it very well. It was bitterly cold. Those of you who know German trains know how overheated they are, but still there was ice on the inside of the window. I remember it. And suddenly, worrying about Cassati, a chain of connections lit up. Gutzwiller, periodic orbits, Hanni Osorio del Almeida, Boigos, Giannone and Schmidt, the rigidity, and the zeta function. Okay. And this resulted in a paper. I phrased it in terms of rigidity, and I should have used the simpler number variants, and I'll describe all that later. And in 85, which described the beginnings of the explanation from dynamics of why it is that you get these random matrix statistics, and more important, how they break down. Let me speak about that a little bit. You've got the staircase of energy levels. That's the counting function. It's a step function at unit step at each of the eigenvalues. Okay, we'll see the same thing for zeta too. So now, a staircase, if you don't look too closely, is like a hillside. Well, that's the smooth part, and then there are fluctuations. And then you've got the density, which is the derivative, which is the sum of delta functions. We like delta functions, because and that again has a smooth part, the average density, and then some fluctuations. Now, there are various two-level statistics that have been studied. You see, there's the pair correlation, which is essentially the probability that if you've got a level here, you'll get one a distance x away, measured in terms of the mean spacings, the details, but it's an average over two of these densities. Then there's the number variance, plays a crucial role. The number variance is this. You look at a stretch which, on the average, contains L eigenvalues. Of course, each sample won't have L. There'll be some number that fluctuates, and it's the mean square deviation from L that this describes. And again, it's something that's quadratic in these densities and countings. Now, it's often very convenient to describe these quantities in terms of the Fourier transform, which is an energy-like quantity, L, measured in mean space. This is a time-like quantity, conjugate, the Fourier transform with some constants. And then you have the rigidity again, the number variance. You can write it as either some transform over the pair correlation or the transform over the form factor. It's a horrible name. I don't know where it was introduced. I wish I'd never used it, but anyway, there it is. And rigidity, likewise, you don't go into details, but that's again a transform over this form factor. Now, to make a theory, you go back to Gutzwiller, who had this expression, still almost the only tool that you can use, an expression for this, as I'm going to describe it, the counting function fluctuations in terms of the periodic trajectories of the... You see, it's a very natural thing to have periodic trajectories. I'll tell you why. What are these energy levels describing? They're describing stationary states in quantum mechanics. They're the states which don't change with time. So it's natural that the corresponding classical quantities appear, properties of the geodesics, will be also those properties that don't change with time, namely the invariant manifolds. And there are two kinds in a chaotic system. There's the whole energy surface, and that size of that determines the average density, or the average slope of the staircase. And then there's the periodic orbits, which are, they're not trajectories, I mean they are, but only they're the closure of over time, periodic, and they don't change either. I mean, they're invariant manifolds. With time they stay the same. Particles move along them, but the whole trajectory is, of course, invariant. So it's natural that this should happen. And here's the picture. You've got a periodic orbit, and I have an orbit nearby which isn't quite periodic. And the one that's not quite periodic, if it starts a distance x away, will come back linearly disturbed. And this is the monodromy matrix, the stability matrix. It's hyperbolic for a chaotic system. And then you need the length of the orbit, never mind the physics terminology if you don't like it, and the period, which is the derivative. Now, here's a way to say it. I mean, you have an orbit which has a period or equivalent to a length, and this action is like the length measured in units of wavelength, roughly speaking. And wavelength gets smaller, like inverse square root of the eigenvalue that involves the asymptotic parameter. And here's the formula. It's a sum over all periodic orbits. I'm writing this as a double sum, it's really a single sum, over primitive orbits and all the repetitions. And here you've got the here you've got the action. That's because this changes with increases with energy, these are oscillatory contributions, lots of oscillations adding up, one dreams, to give these steps. And here's the monodromy matrix, and these are certain phases which I'll briefly mention later, but not for a bit. Now, there are two important properties. All of the statistics I've talked about so far are bilinear in these spectral fluctuations, and so they can be written as double sums over periodic orbits. And it's natural with a double sum, Eugene has spoken in great detail about subsequent developments of this, that to separate sums into their diagonal parts and their off-diagonal parts. Very natural thing to do. Now, secondly, the sums involve all orbits. Some are short and some are long. There's something I didn't mention. Sorry, let me go back. There's also this mysterious Planck's constant, which for mathematicians, physicists, you know what it is, and for mathematicians, it's just a measure of asymptoticness. If you make Planck's constant smaller, it's like looking higher and higher up in the spectrum. Excuse me for forgetting that. So here we are. You've got short orbital. Now, they give different types of contribution. You see, recall, the contribution of an orbit is oscillatory, and the period is the rate at which this phase changes. Now, an orbit with period T represents a spectral oscillation with an energy period, Planck's constant, divided by T. And the long orbits describe spectral fluctuations on small energy scales, and that's what random matrix theory mainly dealt with. And short orbits describe spectral fluctuations on larger energy ranges, just by this duality, which is another expression of Heisenberg's principle. Now, oh yes, one thing I did immediately was to apply this idea, it was not very difficult, to non-chaotic systems, integrable systems. And I'm not going to give the formulae now, because it's only tangential, but just to see whether this would explain these observations of Kasaty and Chirikov and colleagues. And the idea was that the long orbits would have a certain universality. Actually, in that case, Michael Tabor and I had found it in our 1977 paper, but that we hadn't recognised it quite what it was, but we had the formula. And the short orbits, well, there's a shortest one. So there's a limit to the fluctuations. You can't have fluctuations on all energy shows. There's a limit. So at a certain point, you had to have a change. And so we were able to predict how this universal and non-universal behaviour. These little oscillations depend on the kind of system, but here's the universal, in this case, Poisson. So that worked, but the real emphasis was chaos. Now, here's where the Hanyo Zorio sun rule came in. The long orbits display this wonderful universality. I'm going to talk about it very, very roughly. The number of orbits between period T and D plus DT grows exponentially. This proliferation is a property of a chaotic system. There are enormous numbers of period of orbits. They grow very fast. On the other hand, the contribution in the sun that Martin Gutzler had found, it decays exponentially with half this exponent. And lambda is a measure of the entropy. Measure of the instability. And so if you take the square, the proliferation, the intensity, we need that because we've got a double sum in the diagonal part of it anyway. The proliferation cancels the decay and leaves you something rather simple. And they were able, brilliantly, to write this in terms of a sum rule which didn't involve any quantities to do with quantum mechanics. You take these classical trajectory intensities and you multiply by the density and take the limit as t goes to infinity, and it goes to 1. Never mind the details. Now, there had been some a very important mathematical literature of a similar kind, equidistribution, starting with Margulis in the late 1960s, and Parry and Pollicott had developed. There was an overlap between these concepts. In each of them were more and less general than the other in certain cases, but this was what, as I didn't know until later, but this was what certainly inspired me. And what I was able to find was that using this diagonal sum was that the form factor behaved linearly for times that weren't too close to 1 and weren't too close to 0. I've just drawn it like that. Well, good, that was something, because this was the form factor of the Gaussian unitary ensemble, where there was no symmetry that was interesting at that time. So that meant one was on the right track. But still, to find rigidity, you need a transform, and you need more than just this part. And then came something called the semi-classical sum rule, which I could find that this had to go to 1. And this is based on the following idea. You've got this sum of a period of orbits, which has to describe singularities, steps or delta spikes. Now, of course, it can only be conditionally convergent, and the singularities have to be hidden away in the infinitely long orbits, which oscillate fastest. So you could throw away any number of the first few orbits, and any truncation of that sort, where you kept the tail, had to somehow have encoded in it the singularities. And in particular, the average density of the singularities. And that gave rise to an identity involving the double sum. I won't go into the details of that, but that's what gave this rule. Now, the simplest interpolation, this was so naive, between these two formulas, is actually precisely the Gaussian unitary ensemble form factor. And so I thought there has to be something in this, but I was puzzled by one fact, which I'll come to in a moment. But I just want to say that, of course, you learned from Eugene, with his work with John Keating, that subsequent developments have enormously refined these ideas. But there's something that's still not, I think, totally understood, certainly not for all the ensembles, and that's this jump here. Now, it's like a phase transition, but it's a phase transition where the phases in these exponents, these complex exponents, have to conspire in the double sum to cancel what you'd get if you just kept the diagonal term and make it go to 1, but with this discontinuity there. And that's still, I think, an interesting phenomenon. I don't want to say more about it. Now, when we applied this to rigidity, it gave an interpretation of the random matrix formula. It gave this logarithm. I just want to say that this also incorporates the long orbits in the off-diagonal contribution. That's this tail bit here. Now, and hence, of course, all these other bilinear statistics, and of course with these vast and wonderful extensions and all the other statistics too. Now comes the application to zeta, which was part of that paper. The fluctuating part of the counting function of the Riemann zeros, as several speakers have told us, is to do with these phases of the zeta function on the critical line. just as you go onto the groove. I mean, this is a simple idea. Every time you pass a Riemann zero, the phase changes by pi. And so you go close to zero and divide by pi, and you get these fluctuations. And you've already taken away the average counting. Now, the point is that you can make this look like this Gutzwiller series for quantum mechanics, and you do that by using the product over prime. Now, you shouldn't, because it's divergent. I know this famous quotation from Heaviside in the early days of radio theory, who was tormented by referees saying, look, how can you do this? With Maxwell, your series are divergent. And he wrote at one point, this series is divergent, so much the better. Now, here, it's sensible to say that, because we're going to make an analogy with the quantum Gutzwiller formula, which is also divergent. Now, that's okay. I mean, things get put right later. We'll deal with it eventually. So, you have this fluctuating part. You just expect the zeta expand and logarithm and expand and so on. You get it. And by the way, it's not total nonsense. If you truncate it, you can reproduce the jumps more or less. I mean, it's not total rubbish, although it's almost rubbish. We come back later to that. Enormous refinements. Now, you see, this resembles a formula from quantum chaology. There it is. Now think about the long orbits. For the long orbits, this determinant is very large, and the expanding eigenvalues dominate, and without going into details, this determinant grows exponentially. And so then you've got this formula that looks very much like the Riemann formula, as I'll now show you. You see, there's the Riemann, and there's the quantum. Now, look. In both cases, you have something that decays exponentially, you've got something that oscillates, you've got phases, we'll come to that now, actually. I will mention it only now, actually. There was a puzzle for many years. How could these phases all be pi? You see, if for an orbit you have a phase of 2, which will give you pi, twice around the orbit will give you 2 pi, it'd be nonsense. Alan Kahn has a very clever suggestion to explain that. I don't want to describe it, I just want to say that I think it's the germs of an understanding of that are now with us, thanks to him. But you can make a dictionary. Here's a dictionary between the quantum and the Riemann. You see, the oscillations are determined by the primitive orbits p and the repetitions m, analogous to the primes and integers, multiples that appear in the sum. These dimensionless quantities that appear in the oscillating functions are mt log p, the periods multiples of the fundamental period, multiples of logs of primes, crucial thing. And the stabilities, it turns out the exponents are all 1, and the asymptotics analogous to quantum semi-Passover is t going to infinity. I could say a lot more about that, but I'm not going to. Now, this dictionary is part of the story, and you might ask, what is the analogue of the Hannay-Osorio sum rule? Well, actually, it's the prime number theorem. This is a very nice, satisfying part of the analogy. Now, that's because we don't know what this Riemann system is. I mean, it's a fantasy. But nevertheless, there's enough information there for one to take the fantasy seriously and apply this quantum theory of spectral fluctuations. And I did that. Just to make a point, the first thing to do, excuse me, was to look at this phase-phase transition. And you see, I wanted to see that discontinuity. You know, I'm, as I said, lousy. I had this little tiny portable computer in those days. And I didn't look at the form factor. I looked at the integral of it, which instead of going linear and straight, goes quadratic and linear. But still, there should be a thing. And here's the formula that this should be like. This should be a certain sum over primes. So I computed with a few thousand primes. It could be done vastly better now. And I was very, very pleased to see, you see, here's the diagonal part of the sum, which goes on increasing forever. See, that was predicted. But when you put the double sum in, it did indeed moderate, and it became linear pretty well where predicted. For this case I looked at, I don't remember the details of what E I chose, how high up I chose to look, but there was the phase transition going from quadratic to linear. It was pleasing. Now, at that time, John Keating came to Bristol to be my research student, and didn't get involved with this Riemann stuff for a few years. He was working on the CAC map, which I already mentioned, and did very beautiful work showing that one of the conjectures that John Hannay and I had made in our original paper was wrong, and going into the number theory, teaching himself number theory in much greater detail. There was a meeting in Cuernavaca later. I put this analogy in the 1985 paper, but I went into it in a little bit more detail in the 1986 proceedings of this Cuernavaca meeting, and in particular an idea which will come up later, that there might be a quantum analogue to the Riemann-Siegel formula used to compute the Riemann zeros. I'll come back to that. Now, from Oriol and Marie Joya, I'd learned about this fellow Andrew Odlyzko, okay, and that he'd done computations. And I found his paper, and I was stunned by this beautiful paper about the Riemann zeros. And I wrote to him, and he was extraordinarily generous. And this is the perfect laboratory to test these theories about the universality and the non-universality and so on. So just to show you again, this is not part of this non-universality story, but still the spacing is distributed, 10 to the 20, it came later. Beautiful, beautiful agreement, a perfect fit to the Gaussian unitary ensemble with the quadratic repulsion. Showing that whatever matrices there were involved, if there were any with the Riemann zeta function, they weren't real symmetric, they would be complex Hermitian. That's a relevant ensemble. But as I said, he very, very generously made available his data. He plotted the formula I sent him with his data, and I said, let's write a paper together, and he said yes, but then after a while, everyone knows, I think, in this story, how bad he's been about publishing some of this epic work. And he just said, look, I'll go ahead and write it yourself. So I did, but he should have been an author. You see, just another point. He'd also shown how beautifully the pair correlation of the Riemann zeros agreed with this data fit, which is the GUE, and which, of course, as I discovered then, was Montgomery's conjecture from 1973. Montgomery conjectured this and proved a bit of it. In this way of speaking, what he proved was the way in which the oscillations decay to one as you go far away. In the other picture, it's the linear part of the form factor. But you see, look, this is only up to three. So this is really short range, so longer range. And he didn't do the rigidity, the number variance. And here's his picture. Here's the Gaussian unitary ensemble. Here is his data. Now, those dots. And of course, he saw this falling away. And there was a suspicion for a little while that, although he guessed that there would be, because of the structure of the prime, some deviation, he did wonder whether there was a mistake in his code. But with the formula that I sent him, which I'll tell you in a minute, it agreed rather well. So we thought, let's go further. And this is up to 20 now. Previous picture is up to 3, and this is up to 100. And you can't quite tell, but there are two curves here. And notice spikes and wiggles, which I'll come back to. But at the moment, I'm just seeing it agrees nicely. Right up to 500,000. Now, 500,000 is still small compared to 10 to the 20. So there's still local statistics. But these oscillations, they come and the theory kept working beautifully. And this was very satisfactory, and I'll tell you where it came from. You see, it's based on this. Using these sums of periodic orbits applied to Riemann, you've got the universal part, which is from the large primes, using the Hannes-Zorro sum rule, which is the prime number theorem. And then there was this non-universal part, for which the short primes played a part, and here they are. An approximation to that is from the diagonal sum, where you have this sum over primes, and there's this tall star which is somewhere between 0 and 1. It's insensitive to where it is exactly, provided you're high enough up. So this is what I computed and what Andrew plotted, and we were pleased with this. But two subsequent developments, which I'll interpolate now, greatly refined this picture. One, which really astonished me, is that this sum can be evaluated in closed form. And this was done by Bogomolny and Keating, and by Fuji, who I'm very pleased to meet here. Are you here in the audience now? Yes, good. And it really astonished me that this could be summed explicitly, and there's an aspect of this explicit sum which I don't think they emphasise enough, the creators of this formula, which is the following. You see, here it is, in terms of the zeta function of 1 plus I xi, and xi is a measure of the distance up the critical line, measure of the separation that you're looking at. So it's a small quantity. Right. Now, so here's a point. The correlations of the Riemann zeros for enormously high values of t on the critical line are related to the Riemann zeros on the edge of the critical strip, not quite the line, for small values of psi, which is an amazing kind of spectral resurgence, this property. The low Riemann zeros appear as resonances, as we say, because you're not on the critical line here, you smell them as you go by, they're peaks. And that explained various things. First of all, just look at the correlation function. Here's the GUE regime that Montgomery's conjecture was concerned with, and that the early computations have indicated. But you go far enough, this is the first of those resurgence resonances. One by one, the low Riemann zeros give you features in the correlation, and that explained these peaks that were in the picture I showed you before. One by one, you're smelling the lower Riemann zeros in the correlation of the high one. Hidden in this observation from their formula is, I think, something deep. I think they've uncovered something, a deep feature, which is still secret. From me, I mean, it's a secret, not that I know it, I'm not telling you. Nobody knows it. Now, the other point is, here are these small deviations. I'd noticed these, and I had written, these rapid oscillations are probably an artifact of averaging. In other words, I blamed Andrew Odlyzko for his data averaging. Well, this was completely wrong. And again, the other surprising development with Eugene and John Keating was that if you take this correction to GUE and have not just the non-universal corrections to the single sum but to the double sum, then there's another zeta-like formula which you can calculate, and what this adds is precisely the description of these little oscillations. See, there's what we all want to understand. Unfortunately, I don't have for exactly this case the comparison, but I have it for zeros near the 10 to the 9th, and that's a little bit of the range of the variance, and look how beautiful it is. So very, very refined details there in this theory. Now, the intellectual current in this has flowed from quantum towards Riemann. But the interaction of these subjects is actually a two-way interaction, and in the last part of this talk I want to show you, with one little exception at the end, how the current has gone the other way. Now, this is from the Riemann-Ziegel formula, which was discovered by you. It's a known story. It's an accurate way of calculating the zeta function on the critical line, discovered by Ziegel as scribbles in Riemann's papers. Many of you must have seen this from Edward's book. And refined. And here it is. It approximates this function, which is real on the line. Now, theta is this gamma function-y thing, and its large T approximation is the counting function, average counting function of the Riemann zeros, as has been discussed. Times zeta, this is a real function. It follows from the functional equation. It's real on the line. And Riemann's way, which I could... indeed did, actually, in this very room, but I'm not doing it again, was to a fiendish application of his then-invented method of steepest descents to get a representation valid for large T. Now, just to make a comment, you see, this method, which was nicely described by Jan Fyodorov, there are laws of discovery. Nothing is ever discovered for the first time. And there were lots of pre-inventions before him. Stokes in particular understood very well. But the real lovely, sharp mathematics was done by Riemann, of this method of approximate integrals that have peaks in them, Gaussian peaks. And it's typical of Riemann that his very first application was to a situation so complicated that even today you hardly ever see it. And it's this. See, the simplest case is integral with a peak. Then Jan mentioned that sometimes the peak could be near an endpoint. That's another complicated. Some of the peak could be near a pole. Sometimes two peaks would come together. He mentioned that case. What Riemann did was to apply, because from certain interval representations of this z of t, his method to an interval which had a peak and then an infinite string of poles. And that's actually a case where you can have a model you can solve exactly, and he found this formula. Anyway, there's a physicist way as well, which is formal manipulation of this Dirichlet series. And the result of, which I'll come to a bit later, but the result of this, anyway, is you have this formula. Now, what is it? You've got something called the main sum. And it's finite, and you cut it off at the integer part of the square root of t on 2 pi. And then there are these corrections, which are... this main sum is very good. See, even the first term, n equals 1, cos theta equals 0, gives zeros with the correct asymptotic spacing. And all these other terms do is to shift them around and give their random matrix fluctuations. And then there are these corrections, which I'll come back to. Now, it isn't altogether satisfactory to have a representative of a smooth function which starts off with a sum which is discontinuous, because as t increases, this integer jumps. And it's the purpose of these corrections, one by one, to remove all the discontinuities and all the slopes. That's not entirely satisfactory. And by the way, this is a series of inverse powers of root t, so it's asymptotic. So John Keating and I looked at this, and we thought there ought to be a smoothed version of this Riemann-Siegel. Now, there were some hints in the literature about this. We discovered afterwards, Del Sart in particular and others had written. But I think we went much further. There's a comment about physics and mathematics. Physicists have write very precise formulas, but we talk imprecisely about them. Mathematicians talk precisely about imprecise formulas. And, you know, you give error estimates and you know they're sharp and they're right. We never give error estimates, we don't know what they are. But nevertheless, the formula are often numerically very accurate. So that's a duality which I welcome. I mean, it's a good interplay. So we have the following terms: z0, there's no 1 and 2 because of the way we did things, which omits them, and higher terms. And then we have a smoothing parameter. Now, what this is the main sum. And this is, instead of sharply cutting off the main sum, it smoothly cuts it off. It's an error function, and you don't want to know these details. It just tells you that it has the function of smoothly cutting off with a width k. And then there's higher terms, which are given in terms of these Hermite functions. And just to show you for Riemann zeta what it does, and then there are these coefficients, which are given in terms of a generated function for the derivatives of the gamma. You don't want to know. Okay, look, here is this function z of t near the first Riemann zero. And there's the function z of t, and there's what the Riemann-Siegel main sum would give, which only has one term in it, by the way. And this is this formula that we had, the zeroth term of it, actually. Now let's look up near, I think it's near the third zero, I can't remember, where the Riemann-Siegel main sum jumps. You get one term and two terms. And here you see hardly you can distinguish on the picture. We, of course, gave numbers as well. And if you look near 200 and so, there's a place where the Riemann-Siegel main sum will predict a violation of the Riemann hypothesis. Of course, the corrections would cure that, but even our zeroth term gets that right. So this is good, and gave us the suggestion that it would be useful in quantum mechanics. And just as there's an analogy between the von Mangold formula, I didn't name it, and the Gutzwiller sum, so there'll be an analogy between this type of formula and something then unknown for finding quantum energy levels. So there are several Riemann-Siegel look-alike formulas, and therefore the quantum spectral determinant, and this has been spoken about quite a lot, this has zeros rather than steps, a much nicer function. It's the regularized product of E minus En, and it's the determinant of E minus H, appropriately regularized, and this is the Hamiltonian operator, the self-adjoint operator, whose eigenvalues we're interested in. Now, if you use det is e to the trace log, and trace log is the periodic orbit sum, then e to the trace log gives you a sum over composite orbits. Now, composite orbits are concatenations of orbits, and these are the analogues of integers, which are composite products of primes and powers of primes. It's the exact analogy. So you sum over all of those, And it turns out that you can resolve many of the convergence difficulties associated with the group. It's still not a wonderful way to compute. There's still a lot of terms in it, but it's well-defined, it's precise. And we found that Martin Ziba had studied one particular system with great classical mechanics, period orbits, with great persistence and understanding. And that's the hyperbola billion. There it is, it's the billions in this domain, which although it's infinite, nevertheless has a discrete spectrum. And he went to work with John Keating, and they applied the knowledge of the periodic orbits of this system, inserted into this formula that I've just been describing, and found that these are states which are even under reflection, or similar for the odd ones, that you've got the extremely accurate match between the quantum, which is the dashed line, and this semi-classical formula, which is the smooth version of the Riemann-Siegel formula look-alike. Okay. Now, I want to... we've got a little while. We started slightly late. Could I have a couple more minutes? I mean, a few more minutes, yeah. Back to the Riemann-Siegel. Now, in one of the things I was doing in the 1990s was trying to understand divergent series and developing some ideas that existed and but to a much higher level of refinement than had been done before. And there were various tricks and techniques. So I thought, well, a good testing ground would be this Riemann-Siegel series of corrections. And remember that this A is root T, and it's the integer part plus a fractional part, which is conventionally written in this rather annoying way. Here's T, and here are the jumps. And between the jumps, Z goes from minus 1 to plus 1. Now, it's really perverse, but it's the standard way. Riemann and Siegel, and Siegel's student Gabka, had various formulations to find these coefficients. And it's a playground for modern asymptotics, as I'll show you. That's the zeroth one. And using this, by the way, this started because, this is what I'm going to describe, because John Keating had found a formal way of getting this zeroth coefficient out of the Dirichlet series. And what I was able to do was to generalise that to get all of them. And it was a more efficient computational scheme than had existed before. But here are the first few, Riemann, Ziegler and Gabkle. Here's the 20th. Now, these are derivatives of this function of Z, behaves in some smooth way, doesn't matter, between 0 and 1. And here are the terms of the series, which, so this multiplies 1 on t to the 10th. A to the 20. Now, any asymptotist seeing this knows that there has to be a simple formula to which, as you go to higher and higher order, this monstrous mess could be approximated by. This is the asymptotics of the asymptotics. We're dealing with large T asymptotics, but how about large order? And, well, that was hard work, actually, because it involved a lot of tricks and almost every trick in asymptotics that I knew. And the result was this. The Riemann-Siegel series is a divergent series. It's of the asymptotic type where you've got a factorial divided by a power. So if you put the A back in there, when A is large, high up, the terms get smaller and then they get bigger. But there's this very unusual decoration, which depends on where you are between those steps. And the decoration, it depends on whether R is even or odd, and it's actually, this is a convergent series, never mind. And you can compare it, actually. The high-order asymptotic theory, compared with these exact... I think it's the wrong way round. Forgive me for that. These are the coefficients of order R, and the different curves label where you are between those jumping points. So this agrees fairly well. And what you can learn is how accurately you can get zeta using Riemann-Siegel, and at least with this level of asymptotics, by going to the least term. And you could estimate the error by resumming the tail. There are ways of doing that. And the least term is the integer part of 2 pi t. And you can get the error estimate. And it's e to the minus pi t is the error you expect and actually get, as I checked. And just to give you an idea, the first zero, there's only one term in the main sum. And the error, taking the main sum and subtracting off down to the least term, there are 89 of these terms, you could get Riemann zeta to 10 to the minus 20. So that's how good the Riemann-Siegel formula is. I want to tell you one more thing, because it's not really part of that story, but it's just the last little piece of work I did a couple of years ago with John Keating. And I tell you it because it contains an idea, and then I'm going to stop. The moments of the zeta function are going to be discussed. What about the negative moments? They're going to be discussed too, I expect. And the point about them is that they're all infinite if you're on the line, because above the first, because you're going through a... if you take the modulus, then they are infinite, because you're going through the zeros, which become poles. So you go near the critical line, delta. Here's the critical line, and here are the zeros, and there you are, delta. Now, as delta goes to zero, you're going to magnify the effects of the zeros with these quantities, and even more are you going to magnify the near coincidences of zeros. So this is a magnifying glass, the zeros and near coincidences and clusters of near coincidences of higher and higher order, and that's the interest of it. And so just for example, I mean, here's the reciprocal of the zeta function on the line, and you get closer and closer and closer, and you see the spikes. But if you take the inverse square or the fourth power, then soon you see that you're only seeing this near degeneracy. Everything else is almost invisible. Now, you can make a theory out of that. I'm not going to go into it, because obviously the high values are going to come from these inverse powers, which dominate the moments, are going to come from near coincidences of different orders. And random matrix theory tells you the probability of those occurrences, and you can convert that into a scaling law for these negative moments. And the kth moment, we predicted, John and I, goes as delta to the nu of k, where nu of k is some arithmetic formula. And there it is. And I've drawn the three random matrix ensemble. The relevant one for zeta is that one, but what we did is more general than that. Now, this is roughly quadratic. And although I've written this quadratic formula as an approximation to this rather refined formula, it's actually given rigorously by a theory of Steve Gonick, and I think Chris Hughes was in part of this work too, I don't know the exact details, where you don't allow delta to get so close to the critical line that you see all of these refinements. Now, John and Jan Fyodorov, I mean, this was got from scaling and from making certain guesses. The reason it became was possible because this fitted into a class of mathematical physics phenomena that I'd studied over the previous 25 years called singularity-dominated strong fluctuations. I want to tell you about them in general, but here the strong fluctuations are the ones you saw, and the singularities are the clusters of near degeneracies. And there's a whole ideology. There are various applications in physics of this idea where you have strongly fluctuating functions. There's some geometric singularities forming a hierarchy. They actually compete with each other. It turns out here that depending on the moment k, clusters of different sizes dominate. You see, large k, high moments, are dominated by near degeneracies of larger numbers of Riemann zeros, and so on. But there were some aspects of that theory, I mean, which were heuristic. I mean, we were physicists, and now normally I'm not terribly impressed by people who prove things that I know already, even though proofs are very, very difficult, and I appreciate it. But here, there were assumptions which really weren't terribly convincing, and so it's extraordinarily valuable that at least in one class of cases here, Jan Fyodorov, and we heard these marvellous lectures. I mean, I think Jan is the doyen of determinant, the matrix meister, and he and John, using these orthogonal polynomials, were able to prove rigorously part of this arithmetic for the moments. Now, that's essentially what I wanted to say, except that, of course, there's vastly more work. Many more people have been involved now in this connection between quantum ideas and Riemann. I mean, I just gave some historical accounts of the beginning of it. I mean, Nina and John Keating with these spectacular results for the moments using random matrix theory to get universal and non-universal aspects of these moments, which of course quite rightly have been so celebrated in connection with the work that Brian and his colleagues, Brian Connery, had done before. So there are a lot of developments, and of course there's always the question of what's this damned operator. dreams to be underlying all this. Now, I'm not going to speak about it. John and I had some ideas. We've done nothing new about it in the last years. But, of course, Alan Conn has done a lot of work, and this is involves concepts that we don't really understand. These concepts of Adels and the like. Now, all I can say about that is, some of you know this, I found this novel called Adele, and I showed it to John Keating. Some of you have seen it, and he asked if he could reproduce it at one of the meetings, I think, in Vienna. And so here's this novel about Adele. Whoops, sorry. Sorry, I have one more thing to say. I'll go back. The deviation of this K-square is rather small. I should have said it, forgive me. This goes up to about 20, and these deviations about 0.3, so it's actually very small. But here's this novel, you see. There it is, and it's a... I'm sorry, this is mathematics out of my league. Look, thank you very, very much for your attention. The last talk of the weekend, we're all tired, and I'm delighted that you stayed and listened. Thank you.
Everyone's tired. There are no questions.